You just heard there an extract from a piece that was composed for the previous Festival of Sound. I think it was 2019. And it's called Worse Things Happen at Sea. But before we get into the history of this harbour as a harbour of refuge and think about the tumultuous storms that caused that the creation of these wonderful piers, the East and West Pier, I just want to situate us. So I'm starting this tour looking out to sea, seated on a bench in a promontory that projects out into the harbour. There's lots of memorial benches here. And I'm looking out and I can see straight through the opening of the harbour, right onto the horizon. I can't see France today, but I know it's there, around about 26, 27 miles away. I know that London is only a short high-speed train ride away, you know, 90 minutes away on the train. It's about 76 miles, something like that. And so today we're talking about routes and byways, the ways that people used to come here in the past, the way they can do so now, the associations that can be made due to these modes of transport and the comings and the goings, really, that shaped the beginning of this place as a harbour of refuge. I talked to Teresa Smith about the meaning of her artwork, so let's just start with her.
Well, it was another one of those unsung stories of, you know, the history of Ramsgate. It was a quiet little bit of information that's just over the doorway of the Maritime Museum that says that the time on the clock above is 5 minutes and 41 seconds behind Ramsgate, the meridian time. But of course, before the Prime Meridian was established in the 1840s, I think it was, there were maps drawn to meridian lines all around major ports, and Ramsgate was one of them. And they worked it out in a fascinating way. There's an arrow slit in the back wall facing south of the museum, and as the light passes through, there's a marker on the floor which is still there. And at midday, the light strikes this marker on the floor, and that was noon. And so the clock in the clock tower above would be set accurately to noon, because that was when the sun was highest in the sky. And the vessels that were sheltering out in the Downs and waiting to start their long voyages, places like Australia, would set the chronometers on ship accurately for noon at that point, so they could map their future journeys over the coming many, many miles across the sea.
So we in Ramsgate have always been ahead of the times. Just think, we can legitimately celebrate New Year 5 minutes 41 seconds before the rest of the UK. I also spoke to award-winning public artist Christopher Tipping about what was historically avant-garde. While you listen to what he has to say, please start walking towards the lighthouse at the very end of the West Pier. This was designed by John Smeaton and built by John Shaw in 1842 and replaced an earlier one that was always getting knocked by ships' rigging. The lighthouse was the inspiration for one of Teresa Smith's artworks and the site of another one that we'll hear more about later. But first, here's Chris to help you imagine what this area would have looked like in the 18th century and to tell you what excites him about the new technology of John Smeaton, who helped to engineer the harbour. He'll also tell us about the perils of the sea that made a harbour of refuge so necessary here.
The architecture in the town responds to its life as a seaside, not seaside touristy, as a seafaring town. Ramsgate looks out directly onto the Goodwin Sands, which is a sort of 10-mile shoal of really dangerous sand shoals, which are covered at high tide, but they're covered in a shallow way so that when the weather is rough and you get storms, they are particularly devastating. I think in 1748, there was a really big storm, not the storm of 1703, but one storm. And it was that triggered the parliamentary sort of petition to build the harbour, which started in something like 1748 or 49, and then didn't finished for 100 years. They built sort of, I think they had like two versions, one that completed and then another one that with two sets of different engineers, both of whom were very, very well known in their day. So again, it's one of those things that, you know, we benefited from the most brilliant technology of the day, which I always think is really fascinating, that we look at these places again as historic heritage legacy and we want to save them. But actually, you do forget that they were the space stations and the cutting-edge technology and the computers and all of that, you know, as good as it got. And I think when places like Ramsgate were at the forefront of that sort of relationship, I love the size of the mass and the monolithic granite to the edges of things. And I was quite upset when they had to put the new railing in around the inner harbour, because obviously there's so many more people coming here now, it's much more activated, and so it needed a railing. It was a health and safety issue, but I was quite distressed that they had to drill into those big monolithic chunks of granite that had been dragged from Cornwall or wherever they were brought from. This is the funny thing about history, isn't it? You look back, it seems like a backward process, but you touch on the moment that those things were done, and at the time they were the most inventive, intellectually stimulating or technologically advanced things that were going on anywhere in the world. There are descriptions of upwards of 500 ships of sail moored in what were called the Downs, which is the sort of safe haven anchorage for ships coming out of Dover or waiting to go in Dover or outward bound to all sorts, all places in the world. And they would hang around in the Downs waiting for good weather or their opportunity. And so all the towns we can see from here, like Deal and Sandwich and Minster, particularly Deal and Sandwich, you know, they were the main points of service for all of those ships. And so the activity that must have gone on was pretty intense. Even if you think of 50 ships at sail hanging around in the Downs, what a sight that would have been. You know, on those days when you look out and you see the clouds are so fantastic in Ramsgate, and you think, well, I could be looking out there and seeing even 100 or 200 sailing ships of a particular period. If you imagine like a ship like the Victory, at its time when it was built in 1765, it was reckoned to be the most complex object that had ever been built. So that's like a space station hanging around. And I just think that we see it as an old-fashioned scene, something we see in old paintings or engravings or something in black and white. But actually, at the time, that was the most technologically advanced set of ships that we've ever had. I mean, the Downs, where all the ships would have sat outside Ramsgate, you know, was the preeminent anchorage for the British Isles, I think. It was one of the most important safe anchorages. And yet, at the same time, it was adjacent to land where people were prepared to prey on them in terms of, you know, wreckers and stuff, but also next to the Goodwins, which seems to be such an interesting parallel, that not only did you have this sort of safe zone for the most advanced technology, I would say, but actually a place where, in the wrong weather conditions, like in the 1703 storm that Defoe wrote about so well, that, you know, I think there were 1,000 ships. So you imagine being on a ship of the line or a man of war or something, and you were caught, like so many were, and you wouldn't stand a chance. And those ships disappeared overnight. They weren't necessarily even smashed to pieces. And once ships became made of steel and metal, or iron rather than wood, they would just disappear into the sand, and that would be it. They would just be eaten and they'd be gone. There are over 2,000 wrecks on the Goodwins that have spanned 2,000 years, and upwards of 50,000 people have lost their lives there. And there must be hundreds of thousands of tons of cargo and material buried in those sands, shifting and shoaling around. And I think, to me, that is absolutely resonant.
Of course, some of that material eventually washes up on beaches, or is uncovered by metal detectorists. More about that later. But now let's return to explore the sound piece Worse Things Happen at Sea that we heard a snippet from at the start of our walk. Here's Teresa Smith again to tell us more.
Worst Things Happen at Sea was one of my father's favourite expressions. He was an ex-Navy man. Worst Things Happen at Sea was also an exploration for me as I get older and appreciate what his life must have been like, being in the Navy, working in submarines, being in stressful situations. And it probably explained an awful lot of his character as a man, and he was quite difficult. I'm glad to say that the harbour gave us permission to install the sound piece in the lighthouse at the end of the harbour arm. And it's a beautiful space with a gorgeous spiral staircase inside, and a privilege to be inside the door and actually looking at the architecture and the workings of this beautiful landmark for our town. It's still functioning as a navigation device, and so there is no public access. Remembering my father's expression, I thought, well, where else on the planet would you need to explore that as a concept, because of the Goodwin Sands and its notoriety as a huge maritime graveyard. And so as that is seen from the clifftops in Ramsgate, at low tide you can actually see the sands. And of course, famously, cricket was once played in it at low tide. Or at high tide you can see the waves crashing into these huge vertical plumes of water. It's always a constant reminder of how spectacular and exotic and fatal it is.
And I understand that the piece used Morse code, is that right?
Yes. Again, that's another reference to my father, because he was a communications officer and he used Morse code as part of his daily work. And so I connected that with the story of the Goodwin Sands and researched the names of the wrecks that are listed as having been lost on the Goodwins. There were so many of them. I found nearly 1,000 in my research. And I typed all the names of these vessels, including those that were known as unknown, listed as unknown. And so it was translated into Morse code and then set at different hertz frequencies, so higher or lower, just to try and reflect the nature of the large vessels and the small vessels that had been lost on the Goodwins. It was very poignant and quite moving to type in the name of a vessel from several centuries ago and imagining what it was like to be out there striking the Goodwin Sands in a violent storm with no means of communication, nothing, you know, you're basically alone and at the mercy of the elements. And it's really quite upsetting to go through that process, and just over and over again, ship after ship, and imagining people like my father but centuries ago in the Royal Navy then, being faced with almost certain death.
Many other ships have left little evidence behind them of how they foundered and their crews perished, but what little evidence that there might be is carefully picked over and examined to bring us nearer to understanding our ancestors. I spoke to Tony Ovenden, who's a very keen beachcomber and very generous with his knowledge.
I'm really into shipwreck debris, because I like picking through it. Like, I love picking through evidence of anything that you find on the beach. I mean, I'm always looking at new projects, and I've got one new project at the moment. I haven't really sort of told many people about it, but basically, back in the days of sail, Ramsgate was a harbour of refuge. And what used to happen was that many of the ships that used to sort of make it to Ramsgate didn't quite make it, and they sank in the harbour entrance. And I mean, it became a bit of a spectator sport during the Georgian era, when people used to rush down to the east and west piers just to watch the ships come in.
And were they looking to salvage items and save people, or were they just looking?
I just think it's the macabre, you know. I mean, there was even paintings. I mean, Philip de Loufoberg did one. Ramsgate and Highgale. Turner did one. William Huggins did one. And I mean, some of the evidence did come to light about 40 years ago, because when they were taking sand off the beach for the new terminal at the end of the east.
Which terminal? The ferry terminal?
The ferry terminal at Ramsgate. Mm. They found 3 cannons.
Wow.
Yeah. And they come from customs cutter. And they were apparently they'd been impressed that they'd been captured. So they probably come from a smuggling vessel or a pirate or somebody like that. But the conservator did make me laugh because he emailed me. He goes, "Here, do you realise one of them cannons was still loaded? Still had the cannon, the cannonball, sorry, and the powder in there." But there's an awful lot of new research to be found in this, because when you think about it, the entrance to Ramsgate Harbour, there's more casualties in that square 100 metres than anywhere out in the Goodwins.
As you've been listening to my conversations with Tony, I'm going to take you back to Teresa in a minute, but keep walking to the lighthouse, or if you're there already, look up and see if you can notice the harbour motto, Perfugium Miseris.
So you've heard by now that Teresa and Mooch enact public artworks. They create artworks with members of the public to build a sense of community. And one of the things that has been a highlight of my time in Ramsgate has been helping to build an enormous replica of George IV's crown out of waste materials, emulating diamonds with bottles, crushed bottles. And one of the artworks that many of us who visit the harbour will have seen, and may well have made a deep impression on us because it was there for some time, is a piece called Perfugium Miseris. And I'm just going to talk to Teresa now and ask her.
Well, it was again another unsung piece of Ramsgate's history. The motto is carved into the lighthouse at the top 3 times, just in the cornicing beneath the lantern. And it means refuge for those in need, because obviously the harbour was built out of desperate need to save lives at sea and as a harbour of refuge. And it seemed to be so discreetly and delicately and elegantly carved, it was virtually invisible. And it seemed appropriate to try and bring that out and write it large on the harbour arm and celebrate the fact that we have a message of humanity and compassion as a harbour motto. Well, it was installed just next to what the building is known as the Brasserie, over on the harbour arm there, and it's in the first berth, and we created a framework at Valuminium, and it was screwed onto the fenders, the wooden fenders that are attached to the granite walls. In total, the letters were 23 metres in length, approximately 1.2 metres high, and the letters Perfugium Miseris were made out of glow-in-the-dark vinyl, so that as the sun faded and the sun set, actually, facing onto the letters, then they would start to emit light. And in fact, on a bright sunny day, it was almost like the letters were beaming light, because the photoluminescence was reacting and creating light.
So essentially, as the waves rose and fell, and as the tides rose and fell, this motto emerged from the waves and then was concealed by the waves and had this sort of eerie glow that reminds us that lives on the sea are in peril, and that it reminds us of lives under the sea as well. So it's really poignant.
Yes, it was set deliberately at the tide line so that the letters at high tide would disappear. And as you say, essentially it's a memorial piece to the lives lost at sea. It was originally intended only to be there for the festival duration, for a week. But it was just an instant hit.
Fantastic.
And it just captured people's imagination. I gave very little explanation. People had to explore for themselves what the meaning was to a large extent. And of course, once you started that process of curiosity and exploration, then people really start to educate themselves as to why this motto exists in the first place, why we are ideally placed to be here as a harbour refuge. But because of its popularity, we left it up there for as long as we dared, given it's the nature of its construction. And when the winter storms were coming, we took it down.
And I understand you're hoping to produce a more permanent or at least a longer term version, is that right?
Yes, we've got planning permission for a 5-year new version of it, which will be underneath, on the landing stage underneath the Brasserie building and right on the harbour mouth facing the lighthouse and the Latin motto that's carved into it. And so every vessel that comes into the harbour will pass by the lighthouse and the artwork and be reminded of why the harbour was built for them.
When you were working on these pieces, you had to work very closely with the harbour teams, didn't you?
Yes, and it's interesting to walk into the dockmaster's office and talk to them about the inspiration behind some of the projects that I've been doing. And you walk in there and say, well, of course, the great storm of 1703, and they go, yeah, and they all know. This was centuries ago, and they're all, yeah, we know. Of course they do, they're here sort of heart and soul, aren't they? They live and breathe.
Well, it's part of their living heritage, whereas for many of us it's historic, it's interesting, but it's not lived experience. It's almost that generational thing. So many of our fishing families in Ramsgate have been doing it for generations.
Exactly.
It's in the blood, really.
And it's delightful to sit there and listen to what they have to tell you.
Mm.
And it's a privilege to be down on the harbour and part of that world.
And the time it's taken me to walk back from the end of the West Pier to the cross wall, the wind started to pick up and the clouds have come over. We've got a complete blanket of clouds now. As I look over to the East Cliff, the sun is still shining there, but here on the west it's very, very grey. And that's good because the wind's picked up a little bit, so I'm hoping we can capture some of the sounds of the rigging and the harbour around me. There are some famous people who come and have their boats in this harbour. There was a lovely story told to me by Teresa when she was working with some children from Project Motorhouse, which is a fantastic enterprise working with children from Royal Harbour Academy, the Marlow Academy. And one of these children was asked to give passers-by a postcard on which to write their thoughts about the harbour. And she went to the Chandlers and she saw this middle-aged man. She gave him a postcard and she said, if you write on that, we might make you famous because we're having an exhibition of our work. And Teresa sort of chuckled to herself because she recognised this man. And if they'd thought a bit harder, they would have recognised him too, because he plays a rat in Harry Potter films. It's Timothy Spall. And he very good-humouredly didn't let on that he was already famous. And he returned the postcard with not only a beautiful watercolour drawing, because he learnt to paint when he played Mr. Turner, but also a really evocative poem thing. Join me as I walk back towards the Sailors' Church. So we're still next to the harbour. The wind's really starting to pick up now. I hope you can hear that. And I'm taking you to the Sailors' Church, which is an absolute jewel. And sadly, in these COVID times, it's not open to the public. It's also, I think, a building that's very much under risk of serious damage if it's not looked at almost immediately, really. The Sea Cadets used to be upstairs and they'd have lots of fun jumping around, and now they're in the Sea Scouts are in the opposite building. But this building, the Sailors' Church, has also got something next to it called the Ramsgate Home for Smack Boys, and it says, you can see, they're founded in 1881. So the sound of noisy, romping children is quite appropriate, really, and that was the theme of a sound piece for a previous Festival of Sound that was made by Emily Peasgood, who's one of our resident artists, very well renowned, award-winning artist. I want to tell you a little bit more about the church and the Smack Boys, but I may have to go somewhere a bit quieter to do so, so bear with me as we just capture some of the final sounds of the harbour. And then I'll find somewhere to shelter and carry on our story. So we've heard about the really difficult lives that sailors had at sea through the ages, and we're always aware of the perils of the sea here. This is a working harbour, full of lots of different sounds and sights, and very much the beating heart of Ramsgate. Walking past the harbour office, and coming up to the Ramsgate Home for Smack Boys, which was founded in 1881. It's a very ornate Gothic style of building, got some crenellations that look like a castle at the top, and some beautiful sunflowers. Do look up and have a look at that sort of arts and crafts feature. So I'm going in, and I'll join you when we're going up the stairs. It's a very sort of municipal looking building inside, not quite as 19th century as outside. I'm at the top of the stairs, and you can probably hear some more modern printing noises, but let me just show you something rather special. I'm going to open a heavy fire door. And inside a room that's lined with wooden lockers, and the smell just hits you, that smell of wood. It's a tiny little room, rather claustrophobic. It's about 12 foot long. And it's lined with there's numbered lockers, so there are about 55 for the number of Smack Boys that would have their belongings accommodated in this place. So the lockers are about barely 1.5 foot by nearly 2 foot, not very big. I'm just opening up one of the metal clasps and opening up. And there I've got cobwebs, you can see cobwebs. And you can see inside a little wooden locker that's just big enough for the boys to put their meagre belongings in, their clothes bundled up in a little bag, stashed in there while they go and they have their lessons. So all that they owned in the world would be contained within the four walls of that little locker, within the four walls of this little room. And very, very few people get to see that little unique slice of history. Well, we're going to leave the Smack Boys, and we're going to leave that rather poignant history as we go outside and we continue our walk. Emerging into the daylight and the bright, jolly scenes of the harbour. Cyclists going by. We mustn't forget that the harbour, of course, played a very important part in the Second World War. We've got on the slipway the Medway Queen. She was one of the Dunkirk little ships. There's a wonderful memorial window to the Dunkirk veterans and those who rescued and helped them in the St. George's Church in the centre of town. But here, outside on the sailors' attention. Church...
Lifeboat launching.
Now, that was quite timely, wasn't it? The lifeboat was launching.
The crew will be arriving.
Okay, we've got a plaque that says HMS Fervent, commemorating the men and women of Allied Coastal Forces who served with the Royal Navy at HMS Fervent Ramsgate between 1939 and 1945. And it tells us that from here, motor torpedo boats, motor gun boats and motor launches carried out vital operations against enemy naval forces and protected British shipping in the Channel and North Sea. Many gave their lives, their skill and courage, making a valuable contribution to the success of the war at sea. We will remember them. Refugium Miseris, refuge for those in need. I'm going to play you out with a snippet of a choral piece composed by Mike McAvoy, Refugium Miseris. Then we're going to walk up the steps to Nelson Crescent, or you can go around the slope. And when you get there, look at all the blue plaques. There's so many of them, including Lord Nelson and Lady Hamilton. And there's another very important piece of maritime history up there as well. If you walk back towards the tidal ball. This is towards Liverpool Lawn. It overlooks the sea. It looks like a flagpole, but it had a basket on it that would be lowered and raised to signal to ships out to sea that it was safe to enter our harbour, the Harbour of Refuge.
I'm now on Nelson Crescent, so that's at the top of Royal Parade. You can either go along Military Road and up the slope, or you can brave the steps, those many, many steps that take you up in a zigzag up here where it's a little bit windier on the West Cliff. And I'm looking at two blue plaques. There's one for Alfred Luck, and he was a man who ran a lugger, the Caroline, with Pugin, and together they used to go out and look for people who were in danger that they could save. And the other one is Wilkie Collins. Well, he's got two blue plaques in Ramsgate. He's got one on the East Cliff where he used to stay with one mistress, and another on the West Cliff where he stayed with his second mistress. And they had between them children, and the children used to play together, but the mistresses never met. So from here, we can walk towards Addington Street, and that was the main shopping street in Van Gogh's day and in Wilkie Collins' day. Before that, it was all about the Napoleonic Wars. So let's walk now towards the Paragon and towards the traffic noises and up Addington Street. Paragon, this perfect example of Georgian architecture.
I've walked up Addington Street and I've just stopped before James Street, and in front of me I can see the Falstaff pub, and that was very important during the Napoleonic era, because in this whole area there were troops stationed, and there's something called the Waterloo Room which you can go into and look out in. This newly refurbished pub is a boutique hotel. You can stay there, and if you just want to wander in, they've got beautiful prints on the walls that show you historic sites that we've been talking about. There's one that shows the harbour in Victorian times. There's one that shows the churches we were just referring to, Christchurch, Vale Square, etc. And I'm going to carry on walking, and I'm going to turn left just after I've passed this lovely little bookshop called Moon Lane Bookshop. And I'm standing in front of a weatherboarded house with a bow upper window, a large lower window, because these were all shops at one point. And these houses and the little cottage behind it are more typical of the older fishermen's houses that would have been here. So before the road was built that connected the west and east cliffs in the 1890s, what you'd have to do is walk to the end of Addington Street, and if you wanted to go down, you'd have to go down Jacob's Ladder, and there'd be boat building yards below. But I'm walking towards Spencer Square now, and that's very genteel. It was laid out by an architect called Lady Townley, so she's a female architect. She trained under Sir Joshua Reynolds. It's a bit windy here as I turn the corner, and you've got a very neat Georgian square, and I can immediately see an enormous blue plaque in front of me. But I'm just going to turn into a little garden that I can see turning off out of the wind, opening the gate. So it's open to the public now, but it was an exclusive little garden when it was built, and the idea was that the people in this square could come and enjoy leisure. Now it's got tennis courts. You might even be able to hear people playing tennis. And opposite there is a very grand terrace of houses in what's called Royal Road, and they're all very much the same. They've got a huge pediment in the centre of the terrace, sort of classical buildings that Pugin didn't approve of. And number 6 Royal Road is actually rather famous because a certain young school teacher came here in 1876. Well, he wasn't a school teacher. He was a sort of failed art dealer, failed lover. He came here to seek refuge, if you like. He came here on the train from London. We know he came via Canterbury. And it thrilled him to think about the historic associations because he was a very devout Christian. And the man I'm speaking about is Vincent van Gogh. So he came here before he was an artist, let alone a famous artist. And the square now has a bust to van Gogh in the middle of it. And since 2019, in the summer, it also has an information plaque. So you can read, I'm just going to read for you some of his letters that he wrote here, because he wrote quite a lot of letters here, and those are rather poetic. He talks about arriving safely at the boarding school with 24 boys. He says, "Think it's all right. After eating, we went for a walk by the sea. It's beautiful there. The houses on the sea are mostly built of yellow brick in a simple Gothic style and have gardens full of cedars and other dark evergreen shrubs. There's a harbour full of ships, closed in by stone jetties on which one can walk. And further out, one sees the sea in its natural state, and that's beautiful." Now, he came to teach French and German and mathematics, and he didn't really enjoy doing it particularly. He said, "Giving the lessons isn't so difficult, but it'll be more difficult to make the boys learn them." And he took solace and refuge, really, from the rather shabby surroundings of the little school with taking the boys on walks. So he took them to a wonderful walk to Pegwell Bay, and he wrote about it in May. He experienced the town and all its many moods. He says, "The town has something very singular. One notices the sea in everything. I particularly like the little drawings he does, the verbal drawings and the actual drawings from the school window, and him talking about the boys who stand and watch their parents going back to the station after a visit. Many a boy will never forget the view from that window. You should have seen it this week when we had rainy days, especially in the twilight when the street lamps are being lit and their light is reflected in the wet street." It's very evocative, isn't it? I think he was very, very poetic. One of the greatest word pictures that he writes reminds me very much of a painting by Tissot, and that famous artist admired by Van Gogh was also here in 1876, but just after Van Gogh had left, so I'm sure they wouldn't have met. And Tissot paints from the Albion Hotel a view of a passing storm, and Van Gogh writes about a storm. He says, "Have I already written to you about the storm I saw recently? The sea was yellowish, especially close to the beach. A streak of light on the horizon, and above this, tremendously huge dark grey clouds from which one saw the rain coming down in slanting streaks. And in the distance, the town, with its towers, mills, slate roofs. And below the harbour, between the two jetties, running out into the sea. And in the distance, the light of the lighthouse, the guardship." And he actually saw a signalling to a vessel in distress and talked about the fact that luckily nobody was injured and it all ended happily. Now, knowing of his famous painting Starry, Starry Night, there's something rather marvellous about this final quote that I'm going to give you. "That same night, I looked out of the window of my room onto the roofs of the houses one sees from there, and the tops of the elms dark against the night sky. Above those roofs, one single star, but a nice big friendly one. And I thought of us all." What a nice sentiment to come to the close with of this podcast. I'm just walking across the square now. I'm back to admire the sculpted bust of Vincent van Gogh. And this was installed in 2019 by Anthony Paget, and he donated sculpted busts, all of them slightly different, to all the places that Van Gogh had lived. So some in Belgium, some in the Netherlands, one in London, one in Paris, and one here. So I love the fact that we are all connected across Europe in this community of Van Gogh lovers who want to celebrate this history and heritage, and our history and our heritage. And Van Gogh lodged just over the road from the school in Spencer Square. There's a blue plaque there. You can go and visit his house. And I'm very struck by him looking out on this square. And he wrote about the boys he saw playing here and the lilac trees of the square. And I love to imagine him sitting perhaps in the shade. So he was here from April, just for 3 months. And when he went back to London, he walked the 80 miles, apart from a little stop under the trees in the early hours in Canterbury for a rest. He walked, and then he got a little bit of a lift with a carter, and then he walked until he got to Westminster Bridge. So no quick 90-minute commute for him. So I'll leave you with this image of Vincent in his little room overlooking Spencer Square. His trunk arrived shortly after he did, and he put up some prints to decorate his room. He produced two little sketches, and if you exit the square past the tennis courts and turn left, you're back with that view, that sea view, and you can see Churchill's pub that was briefly called the Van Gogh pub. And if you cross the road and turn right and promenade, it'll get you back to Pugin's house and beyond there all fields, and it will take you back to where we started these three podcasts. So thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed my company, and I hope that you've enjoyed learning a little bit more about the history and heritage of Ramsgate and how it might be interpreted through the use of scholarly information and information gathered from enthusiasts around our little town.